I'm Carsten Jensen. I have the great pleasure to be here today with Paul Cech, one of the single biggest influencers on the way I think about strength and conditioning.
Thank you.
Paul, it's good to see you. It's good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Will you tell the listener a little bit about yourself, your background, and what it is that you do?
Sure. I'm a holistic health practitioner, and my background began in competitive athletics as a child. My professional background began when I was fighting on the Army boxing team and through a variety of circumstances was offered the position as the trainer. I also represented the Army in triathlon, so I was training for two sports at the same time. And my company commander told me if I wanted to train full-time for triathlon, he'd be happy to support me in that. So when I told the boxing team I was leaving, that's when they said, "Don't leave, we would like you to be the trainer because your methods of training are obviously very effective. And we would like you to be able to condition the athletes so they have better endurance in the third round and can last longer through tournaments." At that time, I was also doing a lot of experimenting and studying of massage therapy. So I offered to do massage therapy for the boxing team as well. And through a series of events, what happened is I was put in charge of the nutrition, writing all the conditioning programs, managing all the equipment, managing the boxing arena where we trained, and pretty much everything to do with controlling the fighters' health, performance, work-rest ratios, nutrition information. So it was a tremendous opportunity. It was a tremendous amount of work. And the team physician was an osteopath. So for 2 years, I got to learn about how to take care of sports injuries on the job from an osteopathic physician, and I had 30 of the world's greatest athletes to experiment with. So I took all my nutritional studies that I'd been involved in for my own health and performance and now had a group of great athletes to experiment with them on, and studied massage as I worked with the athletes and learned how to apply those different techniques. And within 2 or 3 months, the team doctor noticed that there was a significant drop in minor injuries amongst the athletes and that their performance was increasing. The coaches noticed the athletes were performing better. They were having less struggle managing their weight. So they were very motivated and encouraged me to continue my growth and development in that department. So that went on. When I left the Army, it was 1986, and interestingly, of my boxing team, 11 fighters made the 88 Olympic team. So 11 of the guys that were on my team, and there's only 12 men on a boxing team, so 11 of the 12 spots on the U.S. Olympic team were won by the fighters on my boxing team, which is almost unheard of.
That's an impressive track record.
Yeah, it was pretty good. And so and I later found out that the two coaches that were my primary bosses, who were always the first ones to challenge me on any new ideas that I had and argue with me and, you know, really make it hard to implement any new ideas, it was a paradox because they said they wanted me to keep going. They were happy with the success, but they were always scared to death whenever I came up with new ideas, right? So interestingly enough, many years after I got out of the Army, these guys had risen to very high positions within the Olympic Committee in the United States, and Hank Johnson became the assistant coach of the Olympic boxing team. And another boxing coach that I worked with, Kenny Adams, was the head coach of the Olympic boxing team. And I found out through some of the fighters that I had worked with that Coach Johnson and the other coach were using all the techniques that I had developed in the military, which were the very ones that they used to give me resistance for. So one day I called up Coach Johnson and said, "Hey, what's the deal? I hear you're using all the techniques you used to give me all the trouble with." And he said, "What can I say, man? You were way ahead of your time." But it was nice to know they were still using the methods to condition fighters.
That's a good compliment.
Yeah, in the current world. So I left the Army. I went to sports massage therapy school in San Diego because my dream was to work with triathletes and apply everything I'd learned to triathletes. And that went very, very well. I got certified as a neuromuscular therapist, which I finished in 89, which is a specialist in the treatment of soft tissues for injuries. I later got my license as a holistic health practitioner to operate in the state of California. And I've done all sorts of training and things like that over the years, but essentially since January 84, I've been wholly committed to the study of nutrition, lifestyle, athletic conditioning, rehabilitation. When I left the Army and started my own business in San Diego after I got out of sports massage therapy school, I worked with a chiropractor for almost 2 years that specialized in sports injuries. So I was able to do a lot of cross-pollinating with him and learn a lot of other interesting approaches to athletic injuries. Then I was asked to come work at the largest physical therapy clinic in San Diego for a lady named Kathy Grace. So I got to work at a place called Sports and Orthopedic Physical Therapy, which had 22 athletic trainers and physical therapists and 13 surgeons. They had their own surgical center there. So this opened up a new avenue of exploration for me, and now I could rub elbows with a lot of very skilled physical therapists who were very interested in my work. And the reason I got the job is because the lady that owned the physical therapy clinic was having terrible problems with her knee. She'd had multiple surgeries that had failed, and they'd had to manipulate her knee surgically 3 times. And the surgeon told her that if he had to manipulate her knee again, it may be the end of her golf and tennis career. She was a recreational, sort of a competitive novice or a competitive amateur, shall we say, and really loved her sport, but her knee had developed so much scar tissue that it wouldn't move properly. So her therapists were at wit's end, and one of the therapists was an elite runner who had come to me for problems with Achilles tendon problems that he couldn't resolve either. And because I'd gotten him back into sport and healthy, he recommended to his boss that before she have surgery again and risk all the damage, that she come see me. So in a very short period of time, I got significant range of motion and performance gains on her knee that the therapists weren't able to get. And it was quite confusing to her because as a master's physical therapist, she was saying, geez, all these techniques you're using I've never seen before. Where did you learn all these things? And I explained to her I learned them just by studying anatomy and applying my knowledge of mechanics to the body. And so she was so overwhelmed by the fact that I could do these things and her therapist didn't know what to do, she asked me to come work there, which is how that got started. So it was very unusual for a holistic health practitioner to work in a professional physical therapy clinic, because normally holistic health practitioners, massage therapists, those type of ancillary or secondary or allied healthcare professionals are looked down upon as like second-class citizens. So I came in with a bit of a wild card because they knew I knew something they didn't know because I was able to rehab their boss. Well, that also got all the surgeons excited because, as you can imagine, she was friends with all the surgeons and they were watching her and consoling her and having empathy for her through this chronic problem. Well, once I got there, she asked me if I would strengthen her knee. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to start a lot of professional jealousy amongst the therapists, so why don't you let them have a crack at it? And if they can't do it, then I'll do it. Well, she failed at that. She started losing the range of motion. She didn't get stronger at all. And they were using traditional approaches to physical therapy, isokinetics and rubber bands and all that. So when they gave up, they all agreed, let Paul have a crack at it. And sure enough, I got her strength back. And within about 4 months, she was able to play sports again and function better than she'd functioned, you know, since she started having knee problems, period. It was a bit of a shock to the therapist to see the way I exercise people, because almost everything I was doing, they were taught never to do in physical therapy school. So I stuck with that for quite a while.
Hello.
So through that period of time, I got to interface with all these surgeons, and of course they were very interested in what I was doing. And my success with her triggered an avalanche of referrals from the physical therapists and from the surgeons. I already had a large clientele myself, so in a very, very short period of time, I was just booked solid, sometimes 3 months in advance. That allowed me a number of experiences. One, I got to go to surgery anytime I wanted to. They had their own surgical center there. They did their own cadaver dissections there. So I got to be involved in very deep technical dissections of knees and shoulders and whatever I wanted to participate in. I got to go to surgery anytime I wanted to. I got to see, you know, all sorts of interesting orthopedic surgeries on the spine, on all the joints. so I could really understand what the surgeon was doing, and I could see the limitations of manual therapy when I saw how scar tissue accumulates, how joints get damaged, etc. So it really taught me to value surgeons. It also taught me clearly where they were operating when they didn't need to operate. And so that experience ultimately led me to leaving with a partner and starting our own physical therapy clinic. So I stayed there for 4 years at Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy. Then I opened my own physical therapy clinic with a partner, Steve Clark, which we called Golden Triangle Rehabilitation. He was an expert at the shoulder and the knee, and I specialized in spinal pathologies. That was really my forte, was injured spines, and for many, many years, that was the mainstay of my work, was medical failures. Our clinic was right next door to the University of California, San Diego's spine clinic, their famous spine clinic run by Vert Mooney. And so I developed a relationship with them, and they sent us all their failed cases. So I used to get a lot of these failed back surgeries, sometimes multiple fusion failures, disc replacements, you name it, whatever they were experimenting with. When they had problems, I got to see those patients, and I was quite successful with them, which also caused a significant stream of referrals. After 3.5 years, because of the impingements of the insurance companies and the fact that we were getting less and less return on our, you know, billing, it got to the point where we pretty much made the decision that we could not treat people the way we felt they deserved to be treated under the restrictions by the insurance company. So we decided to sell our physical therapy clinic and try to go out and create an environment where we could do what we want. So I took the money from the profit from the physical therapy clinic and I started the Czech Institute in 1995. And essentially what my work is today is a synthesis of everything I learned up to now, which is 25 years in the career. And throughout the history of my career, I've taken something along the lines of about 10,000 classroom hours of continuing education courses all over the world. And I've hired numerous experts for private teaching and have had the opportunity to share my knowledge with many other experts where we would get together and just swap information to support each other. So my career is really a cross-pollination of ideas from almost every field. And because as a holistic health practitioner, nobody really understands what you do because it's a very small field. They only have them in California and in Germany. There might be one or two other places in the world where they have a similar profession. But really a holistic health practitioner is, when I'm explaining it, it's the closest thing to it is a naturopathic physician. The training is less extensive. It takes 1,000 hours of training in the United States or in California to be a holistic health practitioner. And in Germany, it's, I believe, a 4-year training program. But ultimately, the license allows you to do anything that falls within the realm of natural health. So as long as it's considered natural, it's fair play. So today, the whole function of the Czech Institute is really to share what I've learned in my career about the integrated nature of the body. And throughout my career, as you can imagine, working mostly with medical failures, I had many patients who were such an entangled mess of multiple surgical failures, problems with medical drugs, tremendous mental emotional dysfunction that was not being addressed and was overlooked as a key correlation to their overall condition, be it orthopedic, visceral, or otherwise. I got the chance through firsthand practice to see that the human life is really an inextricable weave of the physical, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual reality. And I found that many of my patients' problems at the physical level were symptoms of emotional, mental, and spiritual challenges that they did not have the knowledge or the support to rectify. They didn't even know how to navigate them. And because of the way medicine is taught and the way our educational system is and our emphasis on Newtonian mechanics, people in our culture tend not to correlate their mental emotional state with their physical state. They treat it as though one was a problem in the garden and the other one's a problem in the garage, and you need a gardener for the gardening problem and a mechanic for the garage problem and a plumber for the plumbing problem and an electrician for the electrical problem and so on. So what people fail to do is see the integration of systems in the body. If you have an electrical failure in your house, it also means you don't have hot water. It also means that you don't have appliances. And it also means that the way you take care of your hygiene is going to change. But you never realize these things until you're in it. So in the body, when somebody has an electrical problem or a plumbing problem or a dietary problem or a sleep disorder or a rhythm disorder, it often shows up as many, many other manifestations because the body, to use an old analogy, the chain always breaks where the link is the weakest. And the source of the pain or the problem may not be in the area of your weakness, but the level of stress that you experience is such that because the body always summates and shares stresses throughout the entire organism, if you already have a genetic predisposition to a weak knee because of old injuries or just purely genetic weaknesses, and you're going through a divorce, you're very likely to end up injuring your knee while playing racquetball or walking your dog or climbing downstairs, but see that to be a knee injury and not have any recognition of the fact that the divorce is overloading the entire biological system and the knee just happened to be the weakest link in the chain. So my work looks at all of the systems that play together in a human being. And what I try to do is not pay so much attention to where the pain is, but I try to look at where the etiology or the source of the pain is. And using a very elaborate system that I've developed over many years, I'm able to track through and look at each person physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. And sometimes all it takes is that I simply identify. So for maybe in this case, the divorce. And quite miraculously, I can have somebody do something as simple as get up and walk across the room and without any other instructions say, does your knee hurt? Yes, it does. Okay, now what I'd like you to do is imagine your relationship with your spouse is completely healed. That you get along and you understand each other and you can communicate effectively. Are you willing to imagine that? Yes, I am. Hold that thought and walk across the room a few times for me as you're meditating on that. And oftentimes they don't even realize what happened. So then when they stop walking, I'm saying, I'm just curious, while you were doing that, how much did your knee hurt? And some of them will burst into tears right there. And they'll realize they had no knee pain whatsoever. They completely overrode it because by changing what's sometimes called in psychology or in the science of language, their pre-frame, the way they view their life, they automatically change the way they view themselves. And by imagining their relationship as healthy, their perception of stress drops, sometimes so significantly that there is no longer any need for the body to use the knee as a vehicle of outlet for the excessive emotion they're carrying in their body. So the weak spots in the body, paradoxically, become like vessels for release of excessive tension or excessive stressful energy. And because we have a history of injury there, we've actually learned how to be in pain there. So the nervous system and the hormonal system already know how to express energy through that outlet. So what most people don't realize is that 85% of all orthopedic injuries are idiopathic, which means nobody knows what caused them. Now that's 85 out of every 100 orthopedic injuries out there. No one knows what the etiology is. So the grand majority of people coming to healthcare professionals for help with orthopedic injuries are actually manifesting the symptom of stress. And it just happens that because of deficient exercise programs, deficient care of the body, and deficient understanding of the body, that they actually think where the pain is the problem. They don't realize it's a symptom of deeper seated issues in their life. So, in summary, that's sort of a snapshot overview of 25 years of growth, development, experience, and accumulated wisdom, really.
And you mentioned the spiritual level,
yeah,
and the mental, emotional level, and the physical level.
Yeah.
Can you differentiate between mental, emotional issue and spiritual issues. Sure. It's the way I understand what you've been teaching us over the years is that the spiritual issues are higher up the chain, so to speak, and may be driving mental, emotional issues.
Yes. So the spiritual realm is just another realm for the invisible, for what can't be seen, what can't be weighed, and what can't be objectified. So, for example, I always find it interesting that there's just mountains and mountains and mountains of research in sports conditioning, in every aspect of healthcare. Yet, even cancer, for example, yet it's well known by anyone in the healing arts, anyone that's got anything to do or has any done any legitimate study of the healing arts, that the most powerful therapeutic agent there is in anyone's capacity to heal is love. Their ability to love and care for themselves. For example, it doesn't matter what kind of an injury someone has, no matter how good of advice I give them, if they're not willing to participate in the process, then no matter how great a therapist I am or you are, they're not going to heal. Okay? So first and foremost, one must have adequate self-love. And second of all, one must wonder where love comes from. Now, I've often questioned researchers who doubt the spiritual realm why it is that when they admit that love is the most powerful healing agent there is, yet it is completely unmeasurable. No one knows how to objectify love. They don't know how to measure it. They don't know how to see it. They don't know how to touch it, smell it, taste it. It's completely out of grasp of instrumentation. Yet people act as though it doesn't even exist and it's not even a reality in the realm of conditioning or rehabilitation. Yet we all know that without enough self-love to care for oneself, nobody will rehabilitate. We know that children that are raised without love often become sick, die, or become criminals or psychopaths. Yet people are so invested in ideas. So the mental realm is the realm of an idea. The idea that I get loved in a certain way. The idea that I love to play soccer versus football versus basketball. So the mental realm differs from the spiritual realm because the mental realm is the first realm in which we begin to objectify things, and all ideas are things. You know, the idea of religion. Christianity is an idea set. It's a complex set of ideas that has circumscription. You can say, this is not a Christian practice, this is a Muslim practice, this is a Jewish practice, this is a Sufi practice, etc. In the spiritual realm, ideas reach a level of wholeness where they cannot any longer be divided. So the idea of transportation or the idea of a horse, we all know what a horse is. But a higher idea than the horse is the idea of transportation. That's still an idea that can be grasped by the mind. If you go to an even higher idea than transportation, you come to the idea of movement itself, which is inextricably linked to space, to time, to thought, to linear experience, something with a beginning, a middle, and an end. But if you go beyond the idea of movement, all you can come to is non-movement, right? Or you go to something that's ungraspable. The spiritual realm is essentially the realm of the ungraspable. It is the realm of holism. It is the realm of completeness. It is the realm of good, beauty, and truth, all in capital letters. So at the level of the spiritual realm is essentially the source and the very essence of what created everything that is. Because remember, nothing can be known as an idea or an experience if it's not known in time. Because you cannot have an experience without a beginning, middle, or an end that you can recall as memory. So certainly we're having spiritual experiences, but they're unable to be recalled as memory unless you're in a reality which memory is applicable. Memory is applicable. It's, you know, right now it's 11 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and I can remember having breakfast. But in the spiritual realm, you can't remember having breakfast because breakfast, lunch, and dinner, past, present, and future, all exist as one totality. So the spiritual realm can be thought of as the absolute. or the divine realm. The word God literally means all. God, absolute, and unconditional love are all the same thing. They express the spiritual realm. So the spiritual realm is essentially the origin of life itself. The physical realm is the expression of life itself. So sometimes the spiritual realm can be thought of as the dancer without a dance, or the music without a musician. And the dancer exists in the physical, emotional, and mental realm, as does the musician. But the inspiration to play that beautiful music comes from the spiritual realm. The inspiration to climb the highest mountain or to swim the fastest 200 meters, these are all basically an inflow, a drinking from, a breathing from the spiritual realm. And because the ego of an individual differentiates themselves from the wholeness of the spiritual realm, the spiritual realm in its totality is synonymous with consciousness, yet the idea realm is synonymous with the ego. So in Chinese philosophy, the idea realm itself is something, and ideas, as you know, can be divided. Ideas about forks, ideas about pitchforks, ideas about surgical forks, ideas about forks in the road, ideas about metaphorical forks. In this realm, those things can all be broken down into separate, perceivably separate entities, which is really our own illusion, because what's perceiving the idea is wholeness. Consciousness itself is undivided wholeness. So consciousness does not need to think, which is what gives us the opportunity to think with it. So the ego is like a light, and consciousness is essentially like the dark. So when the ego looks at something, like you're looking at me talking to you right now, it sees its idea of Paul, but it can only know what it's looking at because it's been programmed to think that people that have two arms, two legs, two eyes, a mouth, two ears, and a nose, we call human. If they stand upright and they talk like a human and move like a human. So what happens is the spiritual realm contains everything. The mental realm contains your idea of whatever you think something is or isn't. So the spiritual realm is essentially undivided wholeness, wuqi, emptiness, non-being. But all things created in mind, emotion, and the physical realm manifest as tai chi, which is yin and yang, the male and female energies, which is synonymous with spirit itself. So when someone says that a horse is strong spirited, it means that they have a lot of life force moving through them. When we say that athlete's got great spirit, it means that they have a lot of expression coming through them. They have a great capacity to move energy through their being, which we see as a great dance, or you know, a great discus throw or javelin throw or 100 meter dash or whatever it may be. But the unconditioned realm of spirit is first conditioned through tai chi. So first it's wholeness, it's undivided. Then it manifests as tai chi, which is called 10,000 things. And it's called the 10,000 things because we can only identify wholeness as something. If we looked at everything that was whole, there'd be nothing to see, right? You'd just be overwhelmed. Your senses would be overwhelmed. It would be like watching 500 television channels at once. You wouldn't be able to comprehend any of them. You'd just know that there was a lot of light flashing. So, in totality then, the spiritual realm is the realm of the unmeasurable, the unknowable, the unseeable, the untouchable in its totality. It steps itself down into the knowable through mind. So mind is always perception of something. So the analogy again is, if the spiritual world is absolute and it's pitch black, nothing's moving, it's perfect, you can't add anything to absolute, then tai chi creates the impression that something's not there. That's what the yin-yang symbol means. Yin is. Yin, absolute yin, is essentially all that can give birth to something else. So the universe had to have been born of yin, because we can see the universe and it's moving. And light and movement are qualities of yang. Okay, so as a metaphor, if I walk into a pitch black room and I can't see anything, I can't know what's there. I can't really know if I'm in a room with snakes, dogs, beautiful flowers or a mountain of gold. If I whip out a flashlight, all of a sudden now it allows me to see things in the dark. So when we use the mind, it illumines any idea. And we often think these ideas are our own, but those ideas are actually already fully present in the spiritual world, which is where the old metaphysical saying comes from, there is nothing new under the sun. So when we choose to play football or basketball or lift weights, we're actually living an idea. We're experiencing the idea. And the emotional realm manifests as the hormonal interaction with our biology. And hormones are the interface chemicals that take ideas from the subtle realm, which we know are real because we can see them on an electroencephalograph or a PET scan. We can literally watch the electromagnetic activity when someone processes thought, which shows us that thoughts are an electromagnetic reality. And that image manifests itself in the brain, and through the neurochemistry of the brain and the connection between the cerebral hemispheres and the sensory motor systems of the body, ideas actually manifest themselves electromagnetically as movement, as changes in muscle tone, respiratory rate, digestive rate, peristalsis. Everything in a thought manifests itself in its appropriate system and location in the body as an experience, and it is the actual movement of any idea through the hormonal system into the biological system that gives us the sense of experiencing the idea. And the word emotion literally means E-motion, energy moving. So it's the emotional realm is very strongly resonant with our biochemistry and our physical reality. And it is the interface between the ideal realm or the mind realm and the physical realm. The emotional realm is not purely physical. It's electrochemical. It's hormonal. It's nutritional. It's all the things that make chemistry happen in a test tube, but it's happening in a body. So whenever there's a chemical interaction, it produces what's called tone. It produces light. It produces sound. It produces color. And when ideas penetrate our physical reality through our biochemistry, they produce light, energy, color, sound, and movement. And all of those things give us the color of emotion. You know, when someone's angry, we say they're seeing red. But when we think they're in love, we think green. And when we think that they're, you know, having a spiritual moment, or if we're talking about Eastern metaphysics, people often imagine the colors of lavender or violet or purple because those vibrations are harmonious with those colors. If we think of war, we think blood red, right? Yeah. If we think of fear of or the unknown, we think of black. If we think of knowledge and truth, we think of white. If we think of untouched virginity, we think of white. And virginity and divinity also represent wholeness, and the wholeness we perceive as white because it is white that gives us the perception of the light in the dark, and evil is often thought of as dark, and good is often thought of as light. So these are all mental metaphors that objectify what we essentially experience in the dream or the thought world, which is why Einstein said your dreams are a snapshot of your future. So I hope that clarifies
it. Does. It was a very interesting expanded definition of movement. I think most trainers and strength coaches will think of movement as, you know, moving arms or legs or moving the whole body.
Yeah.
But you were talking more about internal movement there, you know, movement of the digestive system, movement of hormones, transformation from electrochemical impulses to hormones.
Yeah.
Can you expand a little bit on that again? Did I get you correctly?
Yeah, essentially what happens is whenever you think a thought, the first activity is the depolarization of neurotransmitters. So catecholamines, adrenaline, noradrenaline, GABA, all the different neurotransmitters. You know, there's many, many amino acids and neurotransmitters in the human brain, and there's a whole host of hormones, as you know, throughout the whole body. What most people don't realize is thinking itself is a catabolic activity, which is why people get so tired when they've got to think a lot, right? And the brain is a very, very inefficient organ. It consumes 80% of the blood sugar at any given time it's cognitively engaged, which is why people get so tired so quickly when you're teaching them a new exercise, because they're thinking and exercising. So there's a tremendous draw of energy from the bloodstream and from the muscles by the muscles themselves, but there's also a massive draw on the available blood sugar from the bloodstream by the brain. And the brain, which weighs 1/25th of the body weight, uses 80% of the available blood sugar at any given time. So it's really like some kind of a supercomputer that creates a massive draw for energy. So when somebody's actually thinking a thought, what's happening is that the polarity of the thought itself, the image or the impression of the idea, which exists as a vibrational reality in space, all ideas exist simultaneously everywhere at any time in space. The reason is space itself, according to the book Science and the Akashic Field by Laszlo, space itself is 900 times more dense than steel with a friction coefficient of zero. So as a metaphor, we're essentially like fish in water, and the way a fish doesn't know it's in water, we're walking through space, which is 900 times more dense than steel, but because the friction coefficient is zero, we don't feel it, right? And air or atmosphere is actually something that exists within space, right? Just like your bed exists within the space you call your bedroom, and the bed's much more dense than space, but it exists in space, right? Which is actually, you know, I won't get into the quantum physics of it, but it's all a bit of a trick at the end of the day. It's the trick of wholeness being perceived as division. So with regard to thought becoming movement, whenever you have a thought, it creates the depolarization of anabolic and catabolic chemicals in your head, and the interplay between those chemical components creates essentially light. So the same way...
Is that photons?
Photons. So the same way your LCD screen on your computer lights up, and if you get your eyes real close to it, you can see that screen is a series of pixels, just like a television screen or a data projector. Each neuron in the brain that discharges or depolarizes with any given thought pattern creates light, and that light shines on the inside of your brain, and it reflects itself into the cerebral spinal fluid, and because all the water of your body is inextricably connected to itself, every molecule of water is holding hands with every other molecule in your body, just like space itself. So whatever I do to depolarize the neurochemistry of your brain creates a shift not only in the chemistry of the body, but the electromagnetics of the body. And if I change the polarity of any one molecule of water, it automatically shifts every other molecule of water in your body. So the signal that arises from the heart or from the mind or the solar plexus or any nerve ganglia, whether it be subconscious thought or conscious thought, sends images throughout not only the nervous system and the hormonal system, but through the water of the body, which is exactly how homeopathy works. And because every single part of your body picks up this relative difference in the charge potential. For example, if you think the thought horse, it creates a different charge potential than the thought cheese, than the thought sleep, than the thought green, than the thought blue, than the thought money. And each of those thoughts carries all aspects of itself within itself. So the thought, go to the bathroom, carries within itself the idea of getting up and walking to a toilet. You can literally see, if you hook an EMG machine to somebody, like a 32-channel or a 16-channel EMG, you can literally say, think the thought running, and all of a sudden on your EMG, low impulse potentials will begin to emerge as exactly as though the person's running. I've done this in EMG training before. If I stick EMG wires on you and say, Carson, all I want you to do is think the thought that you're throwing the ball. Well, if you're right-handed, your right external oblique, your right subscapularis, your right left internal oblique, and every muscle in your body that's involved in creating that pattern will light up as though it is already doing the movement. So because the thought and the electromagnetic activity and the electrochemistry and the motor system itself all appear as one, because whenever you're thinking, you're having a hormonal movement which creates the sensation of movement in you. And since movement at the emotional level is unequivocally linked to movement at the physical level, then what you see is that even though we're talking about a spiritual reality, a mental reality, an emotional reality, and the physical reality, they're all just like parts of the same tool. It's like an umbrella or a pool. You know, you can buy a pool cue that has three pieces, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And we can call one physical, one emotional, one mental, and what created it spiritual. But to use the pool cue, you have to assemble the pieces all together, and then you can play pool with it. Well, we're so used to assembling the pieces that we don't even really know it, but we've labeled the pieces. The tip of the cue, the middle of the cue, the handle of the cue. Yet, the cue works as one organism. And it's within the realm of spirituality, because nothing can be out of the realm, or it's non-existent anyhow. Right? So, in summary then, movement is just the movement expression of something that's already moving. The idea of running expresses itself as running. The idea of hockey expresses itself physically as hockey. The idea of eating expresses itself as you holding a fork and putting food in your mouth. If you're having a problem with running, playing hockey, or holding a fork in your mouth, I'm assuming that the problem came at the physical end, but the problem is that the physical body is like a puppet, and the mind is like the marionette holding on to the strings. So if someone keeps having problems playing hockey, I've got to look at their ideas about how they skate, or how they tie their shoes, or whether their equipment's too tight, or whether they're giving themselves enough rest, because each idea needs other ideas to support it. So if the hockey player loves to exercise and loves to play hockey, but doesn't enjoy resting, and doesn't identify as resting as an essential component of hockey performance, then one idea can be catabolic to another idea, the same way that any idea you have in your head has to be catabolic to the previous pattern, otherwise you would never be able to see anything new. If I said, look at this picture of a piece of cheese, and that idea could not be catabolized by the next idea, and I hold a picture of the horse, you'd end up seeing a horse with cheese in it. So every idea has to give way to the next idea, and every idea has to be supported by all ideas linked to it in order for it to manifest in its fullness. The goal of playing hockey is usually to win the game. But if the ideas that you used in the last game are being used in this game, but the environment's different, then the old ideas stop the expression of new and useful ideas. And this is one of the things, by the way, that's held strength and conditioning back, because we have not moved the idea of strength and conditioning forward with the other developments in the realm of emotional self-management, mental self-management, or spiritual self-management. So we've still got people laying on the floor doing crunches and training with the no pain, no gain attitude and using machines that don't work, walking around wondering why in the world of advanced technology, when we can check all this stuff electronically, no one's paying attention to it.
I think every trainer or coach who have listened to this so far can see how important spiritual issues are for the physical body. Could you explain practically how a trainer could address those issues with his or her clients or athletes?
The only way that the trainer can address those clients with his or her athletes is to address them in themselves. It's like anything, Carson. You could not teach weightlifting like you do if you were not an expert at weightlifting. All you could do is go in a gym and experiment with people and possibly get hurt with them and call it a tough day in the gym. So the same way, we have to develop ourselves with knowledge and practice in the field of exercise to teach exercise. One must develop themselves with knowledge and practice in the emotional realm, in the mental realm, and in the spiritual realm. To the degree that you understand the emotions and how they're created and what they express, you then know how to manage them. To that very degree, you understand mind, because it is mind that is the source of emotions in manifestation. If there is no thought, there is no emotion to experience. to address the mental realm, one has to master the mental realm. And the first way you do that, you have to master the art of thinking. Most people are not taught how to think in academic institutions. Paradoxically, they're taught how not to think. They're taught how to follow orders. And people follow orders best when they don't think, because true thinkers always question orders, because a true thinker is also a true problem solver. And whenever they're faced with a problem and the formula that's being used is ineffective, the true thinker immediately begins to question the formula, which means to question authority. So because our educational systems are authoritatively based and come from a rank and order system, much like the military or government, people that come out of academic institutions, paradoxically, have PhDs in not thinking. Okay? This is critical because to actually get to the spiritual realm, one first has to get clear on what it is that they're looking for. Second, they've got to be willing to go explore it. Third, they've got to master it. Then they can teach it. But what we do is we get a PhD and we think we have a license to teach anything that shows up in a book. And the more metaphysical readings you do, the more confused you're likely to get. Because what you're doing is you're sticking ideas in your head that you don't know with any confidence you can experience or execute emotionally and physically. Therefore, what happens is people that try to dabble in spiritual teachings without mastery of the emotional or mental realities only turn these things into more ideas that cannot be efficiently and effectively executed as an experience. So typically what happens to athletes exposed to spiritual teachings by people that don't really have the training to do it is they become more confused. They have more self-doubt. They have more of an inner challenge as to whether their religious upbringing and the new spiritual teachings are synonymous, or whether they're sinning because they're practicing some new form of modern foo-foo spirituality that can't be taught effectively. It's essential to understand that communication is a product of the mind, emotion, and movement. 55% of all communication takes place through gesture alone, without word. So posture, the way someone moves, the way they carry themselves. So one cannot master the realm of emotion and language until they master and understand the realm of movement itself. But because most people are so indoctrinated into the idea of movement as how somebody does during a deadlift or how somebody does, leg press, or how many crunches someone can do or how many box steps they can do in 60 seconds, they keep looking at these individuals with their stopwatch in their hand and with a preconceived idea of what should be accomplished. So an athlete that has very poor movement skills but is very determined could make an amazing score in a 60-second box step test. But to someone like me, I can see that the way they're moving is exemplifying their inner insecurity of themselves or their fear, or I can see that the reason they're trying so hard is not because it's coming from ease, but it's coming from fear of failure. So this type of person will push themselves way beyond the capacity of their physical body without realizing that their performance is fear-driven. And that fear-driven personality also excites their sympathetic nervous system, which disrupts their digestion, which disrupts their sleep-rest cycle. So someone with my kind of training can look at somebody and know even when they're performing well, it's actually part of the disease that has a hold of them. And the reason that's so important for an athlete is because I can identify the pathology as one that's likely to limit them in a career that will require one to handle arduous amounts of stress, regional championships, national championships, tryouts, playoffs, all these things which are highly stressful. So the individual that can make it through tryouts and make it through the lower stress level portions of a season all of a sudden starts breaking down when the team needs them the most. So it's the spiritual reality and the mental reality that I have to work with to help that person reframe themselves and also look at what's missing in their idea set. So maybe they have a tremendous work ethic, but they have a poor rest ethic. Maybe they have a tremendous work ethic in the gym, but they have poor mental, emotional self-management. So every time they go home, they're fighting with their spouse, and they come to the gym as a way of escaping the reality of their relationships. So you see, whatever's out of balance in the athlete's life is out of balance in the athlete's training and the athlete's performance. But we're so used to just objectifying, oh, let me check your hamstring, right? Well, what about the relationship between the hamstring and their financial status or the relationship to God through their religion? You know, what if they're a Seventh-day Adventist, but their sport requires them to train on Saturday and now they're sinning because there's supposed to be a day of rest? So oftentimes people's own self-guilt and shame manifest as tension patterns in the body which conflict against the movement patterns and the biomotor profiles needed for their very sport. So they go into mental, emotional, and physical conflict because the dominant ideas they have, what God wants, go against their ideas, what I want to do for my team. So when they're in inner conflict, it manifests itself as a physical reality of conflict, yet the sport coach, the trainer, the therapist treats that only as a hamstring or only as a shoulder and totally overlooks the reality of the marriage between the physical, the mental, the emotional, and the spiritual.
If I heard you correctly, you said that any trainer must first master his own emotions and his own spirituality before even attempting to teach anything to others.
Yeah. There's a leeway there.
Yeah.
So the leeway there that I think you're looking for is that you must at least master what you're trying to teach to the point that you're what I call at least one arm's length ahead of your students. You know, I say that coaching of any type is like being a mountaineering guide. Yet the moment you cross the point on the mountain at which your mountaineering guide himself or herself has never explored, you no longer have a guide. You've got a partner in exploration. So you're either going to make it to the top of the mountain together or you're going to die out there together. Okay? So using that analogy, whenever you're teaching physical coaching, emotional coaching, mental coaching, or spiritual coaching, I can only take you as far up the metaphorical mountain as I myself have gone. The problem is to be a world-class athlete means that you need to climb to world-class levels at the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual level. So essentially what happens is we have usually very, very undeveloped coaches. Unfortunately, I hate to say this, but it's true, a grand majority of the coaches out there are just inferior athletes that couldn't make it and found a job talking about it, as opposed to really seeing it as a profession that they invest themselves physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually into. Okay, so it's a vocation instead of a legacy for most people. For me, it's a legacy. It's my overarching dream. It's my chief love. So I invest myself fully in coaching myself, conditioning myself, nourishing myself, loving myself, and coming to know myself so that I can share the process of that inward journey and share the process of the challenges that I myself have overcome with self and other, so that the athlete or the individual or the patient has a sense of confidence that I've climbed the mountain that they're embarking upon. Yet I always make sure that if I get any of my students or clients to the point at which I no longer know, I say to them, I can only journey with you as a partner from here forward, which means I can't really charge you. Okay? Not in my ethical system. So in order to bring a strength coaches or an exercise or healthcare professional's practice to this level, they must go on enough of a journey on their own to then come back and recognize in their patients that those patients are stuck in the roadblocks where they have now processed. Otherwise, what happens, it's not experiential, it's only an ideology. And the problem with an idea is that ideas aren't truly experienced until they're experienced in their physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual totality. So it's kind of like, if I go to a party tonight and they have a cherry cheesecake, and I think, well, I'd really like to bring Karsten some of this cherry cheesecake, but I don't have room in my pocket for a whole piece of cheesecake, so I just bring you the cherry off top. And I say, Karsten, I wanted to share the cherry cheesecake, and I hand you a cherry, and you say, well, that's really good, Paul, but what about the cheesecake? All I've got here is a maraschino cherry. And I say, well, you know, that part wouldn't fit in my pocket. Well, when we're doing spiritual or mental or emotional coaching, we're only bringing to the athlete or to the client as much of a pie as we metaphorically could put into our pocket. Yet if we're proposing that we're giving them the whole cheesecake, it's going to confuse them the way if I tried to convince you, no, that's not the cherry, that's the whole cake, you just can't see it. Just eat it and pretend it's there. Well, when I do that, I'm leaving you to pretend what was in the cheesecake. Well, what if you pretend there was something toxic in there and your pretending is so real now you're sick from my cheesecake? Well, if an athlete gets lost in the spiritual realm or the mental realm because they've imagined something other than what the coach intended, because the coach did not know how to package the message in a way that could be perceptible or digestible to the athlete, now what you have is a confused coach and a confused athlete. And that leads both of them quickly to give up on the metaphysical realm or the mental realm or the emotional realm, because they tried something new without understanding how to do it, which would be like turning a kid loose in a world-class chemistry lab, and they'd probably blow the place to smithereens trying to have fun.
Like I started by saying, is that I have learned a tremendous amount from you over the years on both the spiritual, the mental, emotional, and the physical realm through both the Czech Practitioner Program and the Holistic Lifestyle Coaching Program. I know you now have another program called Personal Professional Success Mastery System?
Personal Professional Spiritual Success Mastery Program, yes.
Will you tell the listener a little bit of those programs and how
sure.
those programs can be part of the journey?
The PPS Success Mastery Program is an online training program where I have slideshows with audios. You get a manual. There's all sorts of other supported multimedia support, audios, videos. It actually is a center for personal, professional, spiritual growth and development. And I designed a series of 12 lessons to address the 12 most common roadblocks to achieving physical or personal, professional, and spiritual success in your life that I identified through all the years of coaching and consulting and seeing patients as the 12 most common things to stop you from achieving your dreams. So I put the 12 lessons together in the sequence of the most important to do first. So in the 12 lessons, they are categorized in the order that they will give you the most growth and development, looking at what it takes for us to be a functional, healthy, integrated, holistic being, which means you're willing to see life as it is, as opposed to live in your blind spots and wonder why it hurts so much. The program includes a weekly coaching call from me where they can ask any question about life, about their lessons. It's a no-holds-barred coaching call where I support the students in the process of their spiritual growth and development and answer all the questions that they need. For example, you might be on the phone asking me, how do you address this person's reoccurring back injuries from a spiritual or a mental or an emotional level? And I answer these kinds of questions. So there's also mentors that are all experts in different areas that are there to help the students through sticking points, whether it be business challenges, whether it be communication challenges, emotional self-management, mental self-management. I've chosen experts from various fields to support the students, and they can get side coaching on their own time, and that they're, you know, they pay the coaches individually. I've just collected a group of excellent coaches. So the PPS Success Mastery Center is really ultimately the foundation of how to navigate life. So I encourage Czech practitioners and all healthcare professionals and exercise professionals to embark on a program like that so that they learn how to live and experience holistic health as a holistic lifestyle. Then it's easy because you don't have to remember anything. When this stuff becomes mental stuff, you're always walking around wondering if you got it right or if you can remember exactly what some guru said. So you really just become a walking parrot that charges to be a living dictaphone. In the system I teach, you don't need to remember anything because you know how you live. And to the degree that you live that, and it is your truth, and you can look someone else square in the eyes and say, this is my truth, this is what I live, and you're welcome to look at me top, bottom, inside out, and backwards, and you'll see exactly the truth of it, then it makes your work very, very easy because all you do is go to work and share your models of living, experiencing, and problem solving with people that can benefit from your life as a coach. So that's really what my system is designed to do.
Thank you, Paul.
Hey, thank you, Carson.
It's a pleasure and a great experience, as usual.
Thank you very much. Thanks for sharing.